7 minutes past 8 o'clock. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Gene Purcell. I'm here today filling in for Joy Cardine. It's time again for the Week in Review as we take a look back at some of the biggest news stories of the week with our guests who join us this week. Peg Lautenschlager is with us, former Democratic Attorney General of Wisconsin, former state legislator, currently an attorney at the Bauer and Bach Law Firm. And we're also joined by Owen Robinson. He is a columnist with the West Bend Daily News. And we'll be taking your calls, too, with comments and questions. Our number is 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Don't forget that email works, too. That address is talk@WPR.org. And don't forget you can post your comments directly to the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page if you would like to do that. Let's welcome our guests into the studio. Peg Lautenschlager is with us, and Owen Robinson, good morning. Let's make sure you're both here.
Good morning.
There's Peg. And Owen Robinson?
Good morning, Gene, and good morning, Peg.
All right, very good. Okay, we're going to start, I think, with the Wisconsin state budget. It passed early this morning through the state Senate, heads on to Governor Walker for signature, possible vetoes. Owen Robinson, let's start with you on this. First of all, any surprises as we near the finish line here? And second part of the question for both of you, is the governor likely to veto anything?
Overall, I think it's a pretty good budget. There are some disappointing elements that I'm sure we'll discuss as we go throughout the morning here, but overall, it's pretty good. I didn't see a lot of surprises. I think probably the biggest surprise for me was how little resistance the Democrats put up. In the Assembly, they didn't do anything, and in the Senate, it seemed half-hearted. So I was a little surprised by that, but good to see. So now we're on our way to a budget on time.
Peg Lautenschlager.
Well, for me, the issue isn't whether or not the budget's timely. The issue is what's in that budget, and I think there are a number of concerns. First of all, as with the last budget, Governor Walker is creating a larger structural deficit than we've ever seen in the history of the state. And so the reality is from a fiscal standpoint, it is doing nothing in terms of keeping our financial house in order here in Wisconsin. Secondly, there are a number of troubling provisions that are within the budget itself, whether it be the impact on voucher schools and the tax break modification that was made to it, issues as goofy as bail bondsmen's and other things that have been discussed. I think the budget is one that where taxation becomes more regressive, where the costs are being put on those who can least afford it, and those costs in some manners are great. I don't think it's going to do anything to move our economy forward. It's certainly not going to do anything to create jobs. And so I just see it as wrong. As to Owen's point about what the Democrats have done, my sense is that the Assembly Democrats recognize that if they were to have presented the 200-plus amendments that they had drafted, what would happen, given the size of the Republican majority in the Assembly, is that those Republicans from dangerous or from tough districts where they might have some problems getting reelected would be able to be, quote, cut loose as it goes and vote with the Democrats on those amendments, knowing that they would always have one additional vote that would stop those amendments from coming through. Those partially vulnerable or those vulnerable Republicans then would be able to say, geez, you know, I did vote for the whole budget, but the reality is that when it came to that bail bondsman provision, when it came to that voucher school provision, whatever, I didn't vote for that, but unfortunately there weren't enough votes to get it out of the budget or to change it in the budget. So I think rather than give Republicans that opportunity to seek some cover on some of the more radical positions in the budget, they decided, you know, let's just do an up or down vote. And my sense is that that's why they decided not to play the game, the budget game.
Owen Robinson, Peg Lautenschlager brought up the issue of the structural deficit. How big an issue do you think that is if we're going to turn out to be in the red in 2 years or have that possibility?
Well, Well, and I think that to echo Peg, that is one of the very disappointing parts of the budget, is it does have a very large structural deficit. And I think we saw a couple of the Republicans in the Assembly vote against it, listing that as one of their reasons. And it's a valid reason. There's no reason with the amount of revenue the state of Wisconsin takes in to walk into the next budget with a structural deficit. I believe the Republicans are counting on economic improvement and that the projections of revenue coming in will be increased up, as we've seen them happen in the last couple years here, with more revenue coming in than we had expected in the last budget cycle, which is why we're ending with a surplus. So I think they're expecting that trend to continue to wash out that structural deficit, but certainly crafting one with a structural deficit like that is disappointing. I think the other element of it that was very disappointing was the amount of debt that they're planning to run out. Now, the Republican leadership did cut that quite a bit, and the Joint Finance cut the amount of debt that this budget incurs over what Governor Walker proposed. But again, while using debt to finance things is certainly rational at times, and certainly in this age of practically free money for borrowing lately, it does make sense in a lot of areas. But it's reaching a debt level that's not favorable for Wisconsin's future.
Well, and if I might add, Owen, and I agree with you totally, and we don't agree on a lot when it comes to political issues, I know, but I think the other problem I think that's problematic, and this is true of governors and legislatures of both parties, is that there's this kind of public campaign saying, aren't we fiscally frugal? Aren't we fiscally wise? Aren't we doing these things to lessen government, to streamline government or whatever, when in reality it isn't happening because of these kind of, egg game tricks or whatever, where we're moving one pot of money here or there or whatever. I mean, we've seen that Tommy Thompson, Jim Doyle, and now Scott Walker have all figured out ways to have more money than it appears they have and to spend it in ways that I think had the taxpayers know the financing mechanism, they wouldn't be as happy and wouldn't find it to be as frugal as alleged.
And I'd like to talk a little bit about some of the more specifics here. Voucher school expansion, for example, and apparently inserted into an amendment on Wednesday, there's a new wrinkle to this that would allow for existing voucher schools to open satellite schools anywhere in the state. And then apparently these satellites would not count against the 500 student cap next year. Let's start with Owen Robinson. Why did this wind up getting stuck into the budget at this late hour?
Well, it got stuck in as a means to make sure that for the areas in Milwaukee and Racine that already have school choice, that the caps don't affect them as much. I think the notion, and really it's Tony Evers driving the opposition here, but the notion that Milwaukee is going to open up a satellite school in Stevens Point to recruit kids out of there is kind of ridiculous if you think about it. And even if there was, there still remains the 1% cap in place, where only 1% of an individual district can be choice kids. So I think it's a lot of heat and or a lot of smoke with no fire there, just trying to paint the Republicans as an opposition of public schools. But I think it's kind of ridiculous to think, like I said, that Milwaukee is going to be opening up schools all over the state, and that those districts would even allow it just to recruit kids into a choice program, especially when those school districts are led by people who primarily oppose school choice to begin with.
Peg Lautenschlager.
Well, first of all, to me, the fundamental thing with school choice is this. If public education is indeed failing, which is the theory behind vouchers, I don't agree with it, but that is the theory behind vouchers, sucking money from those schools and placing it elsewhere isn't going to help those schools which already exist. I think Owen and I probably have a fundamental difference in terms of the theory of public education, and it's my belief, as it is many people's belief, that as our founders decided that we really need to educate for the good of all, not for the good of individual children. Philosophically, our country has switched on and off on that, so that now what we have is this philosophy of my children and their education versus our children and the education of our society. With that change has come a push for the voucher schools as well. What concerns me about the voucher schools and the satellite things are that what's really driving vouchers, if you look at the money that's being infused into the political system, it's coming not from parochial schools in your neighborhood. It's not coming from a group of teachers wanting to start a small independent school where they can where they don't have to be subject to the rules which the public schools have. Where it's coming from are large educational corporations that operate nationwide. We've seen this happen in colleges throughout America. We're seeing it happen now in secondary and primary education. And those kinds of schools, if they get a base in Milwaukee where they can have the numbers of students attracted that will make it economically viable, those kinds of corporations, those kinds of entities do have an incentive to do the satellite schools. And, you know, and we've seen internet connections with things. We've seen all of this. We've seen, you know, we've seen crazy recruiting for sports reasons, for all sorts of reasons that really don't have to do with academic achievement and accomplishment. And I think that this just opens another door to afford non-accountability and as well afford these kinds of schools to truly threaten, I think, the integrity of many public schools.
It's the weekend.
Well, and I think
Owen, I'm sorry about that. Go ahead, Owen.
That's all right. I was just going to say that to Peg's point on the wider issue of school choice, I suspect we do have a fairly strong difference of opinion there. I found the school choice expansion in the state budget to be disappointing, but only because it didn't go far enough, but very, very limited. But I do think that as we focus more on children and educating children and giving them educational opportunities as opposed to worrying about the school system, I think I'd rather put my energy on the side of kids and not on a system.
Let's take a moment here to mention the phone number, so if other folks would like to join in, 800-642-1234 if you have a question or a comment for our guests, 800-642-1234. Well, one other thing in the budget relating to voucher schools is that the budget apparently also has some limits on the release of public data about voucher school performance. There's an amendment in there that calls for the Department of Public Instruction to release uniformly how all voucher schools are doing, but it also prohibits the DPI from picking and choosing to release data on specific voucher schools. Now, School Choice Wisconsin says that's to prevent DPI from singling out particular schools and attempt to make them look bad, but State DPI Superintendent Tony Evers says it creates a double standard. Let's start with Peg Lautenschlager on that. What do you think about this amendment, and what should we be looking at in terms of performance standards for voucher schools?
Well, I think the reality is if we're going to have these schools that offer a so-called alternative to the public schools, we ought to be comparing apples with apples. The reality is that we have seen with expansion of voucher schools, not just in this state but in other states, that a lot of fly-by-night organizations come in. There is fraud associated with it. The numbers and the testing scores are no better than the public schools, and that's overall, not just in terms of targeting a specific school. If we are going to do this, we need to have accountability and transparency. One of the reasons why the public schools have had such accountability standards placed on them, why they have had such transparency, whether it be the salaries of each and every person who works in the district, to criminal background checks for the employees there, to test scores by classroom as well as by school, all being transparent, is because public monies are going to fund these things. And when you have public monies going to fund things, there is a public accountability requirement. And what we are doing now is not only taking monies away from the public schools, but we're taking those public monies, placing them with voucher schools, and yet foregoing the usual public accountability that is required when taxpayer dollars are spent. And to me, this isn't an issue of whether or not you're for or against vouchers. This is an issue of when public monies are spent, shouldn't it be accountable and be held? Or shouldn't those monies and those people spending it be held accountable? And I think, especially in a state like Wisconsin, it's a fundamental yes.
Owen Robinson.
Well, there's really two things here. One is the individual measure that's in there, and I think it's a bit misleading to say that it prohibits the release of information. As the language reads, it says that information has to be released all at the same time, uniformly and completely. So it's not saying that the information can't be released. It's saying that when you do it, you have to do it for all the choice schools at once. You can't just pick and choose when to release it and let it dribble out as a political maneuver. So that's the specific language. But going to Peg's larger point about releasing data and having accountability within those private schools, that is a large issue, and I think that there is a public interest in at least understanding that that money is being well spent. However, these are still private institutions that have the rights of private schools, and parents are choosing to send their children there with a voucher that comes from taxpayer dollars. But that's no different than going down and saying that the corner grocery store is now a public institution because people spend their food stamps there. I mean, the notion that money, just because it receives public dollars, automatically makes that a public institution accountable to all the same requirements of an institution that is run by the government is a bit of folly. And I think that the reason that opponents of school choice really push that accountability measure is because it sounds great, but it will also make a lot of schools not want to sign up for it because there's a reason they're private. They don't want those rules.
You're listening to the Week in Review here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking about the news of the week. Owen Robinson is with us, a columnist with the West Bend Daily News, and we're also joined by Peg Lautenschlager, former Democratic Attorney General of Wisconsin, a former state legislator, and former U.S. attorney as well. We'll continue our discussion and continue on with the state budget probably for a few moments. If you'd like to join in, 800-642-1234. I'm Gene Purcell. I'm here today filling in for Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Minutes past 8 o'clock. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Gene Purcell in for Joy Cardine this week. It is the Week in Review, and we're joined by Owen Robinson and Peg Lautenschlager as we talk about some of the big issues of the week. We've been focusing on the state budget for the last few seconds, and we're going to continue with that right now. Let's go to a phone call. Tom joins us from Madison. Hi, Tom.
Good morning, folks. I appreciate your program, and thanks to the guests for being there. I can't help but I've got a pretty large family, and this voucher debate and the choice debate has been discussed, you know, ad nauseum at times. And it seems to me that within family and even family and friends, there's an underlying tone of race, religion, and athletics. And it just doesn't appear to be talked about. Now, we all can recognize that the academic quality that some of the public schools are producing in the students isn't as good as it should be. There are a lot of different reasons for that. But I capture this, I'm getting this underlying tone of, we don't want our kids to go to school with brown people. I hope that I'm wrong, but it's in there. And I don't know if either of the guests could comment on that or if I'm completely off my rocker, but anyway, I'll take my response off the air or off the phone. Thank you.
Tom, thanks for the call. Peg Lautenschlager, let's start with you.
Whoa. You know, it's always hard to determine individual motivation, and so I certainly don't want to characterize parents who are hoping to send their children to private schools or parochial schools as doing it for what Tom essentially is saying are racist reasons. Whether or not there are individuals who have racist reasons for doing certain things, obviously we live in a society where racism exists. I think what's most problematic to me is this notion of changing the public obligation to students for education from a philosophy that we have public schools where we must educate all children, to this notion that somehow the government owes parents, read taxpaying parents, a certain amount of money for each child they have so that that child can obtain choice in education. So essentially we have gone from a system where we create an institution which serves all children, and, you know, we can go into special needs kids and all of the other things that come with the voucher debate, versus a system which is predicated upon somehow the government and taxpayers owe you as a parent and your child a certain amount of money to choose a school. And frankly, I don't think the idea really matches up with conservative philosophies and values, number one. And number two, I don't think that it serves the public well, because with that type of system, all of our own peculiarities, whether it be that someone is racist, whether it be that somebody thinks their child is smarter than all the rest of the kids at school and deserves a different academic program or whatever, suddenly we are always focused on what that individual child and his or her parents have a right to expect, as opposed to what we ought to offer as a society to all people and all families and all children. And I think that that's what's most troubling at the philosophical base level of these schools.
Owen Robinson.
I think it's interesting that I think Peg and I heard Tom's comments and we took them completely differently. I took his comments of an undercurrent of people not wanting their kids to go to school with brown people to characterize the opponents of school choice. Because as private schools now accept choice kids, many of those do tend, especially in Milwaukee, come from brown people, frankly. It's interesting that Peg, you took that to mean it to characterize people who support it, and I took the other way, but a little anomaly there. But to your bigger point, I don't think that the supporters of school choice, and I say this as one, see it as a philosophical, like the government or the taxpayers owe the parents anything to educate their kids. I see it as we want all kids to have a great education, and we can't be locked into a mindset that a great education can only come from a fully government-funded, government-run public school system. I think the public schools, particularly in Wisconsin, do a fantastic job, and I think the underlying goal of making sure we have an educated citizenry so they can make educated decisions about their lives and move forward, I think that's a marvelous goal. And I don't think school choice is ever going to endanger the overall public school system. And I say this as someone who's my kids have never seen a public school. They've always gone to private school. By the time I'm done, I will have spent well north of $100,000 on private education, money the taxpayers didn't have to pay. At the same time, I'm paying my property taxes and my income taxes and all of those and helping fund public schools, which I am delighted to do because I see the value that that brings to my community and to my state.
I think, Gene, if you use your imperfect analogy of food stamps, giving someone a voucher for education is no different than giving somebody food stamps. And so as a result of that, I do think that the vouchers have to be considered as a handout. Frankly, my husband and I have raised four kids, but for one of them for a few years, they all went to public educational institutions. We funded them to go to college. Is there an obligation for us to get some sort of money for them for college as a result? And, you know,
if you look at the
$100,000 limit's pretty low when you're talking even about state colleges this year. I guess the issue is, you know, how far do we as taxpayers extend these privileges, and also then, you know, and why are we paying for two systems or more?
Well, I think here then you undermine what is often the liberal argument. And you see a lot of Democrats who do want government to support college education, but right now you and I, Peg, are in a privileged area where we can afford to make those educational opportunities available to our children. There are many people who are not. And so while a voucher may be characterized as a handout, and I think that could be a fair characterization, it's a handout that goes to educating kids, and I think that's a great thing.
We've got one more call here on vouchers that we'll take, and then we'll move on. Ivy joins us from Evansville. Hi.
I heard the argument about accountability, and it just struck me as kind of hypocritical because on one hand, the conservatives in Wisconsin are calling for stricter regulations around the use of food stamps. So we help people and we expect them to tell us that they're using the money we give them for what it's meant to be used for in terms of Medicaid and all that. And that's okay, but why doesn't that apply to voucher schools? Why do they not have to be accountable if we require that from all those other programs?
Ivy, thanks for the call. Let's start with Owen Robinson on this. Do you see a double standard there?
Not at all. The difference is that when you talk about accountability with the use of food stamps or, you know, things like that, you're applying that accountability to the person who's receiving and spending that money. You are not requiring accountability from the institutions receiving that money. Those regulations don't go out to the individual grocery stores and penalize them for or make them provide documentation and reporting of how food stamps are used or how much, if it's used for appropriate purposes or not. In fact, much of the debate that we had just recently about using food stamps for junk food, there's not a lot of data underneath that to even know how much is being used because we don't do that. In this case, we already do provide accountability to parents in that if they're issued a school voucher, they can only use it for a school, and they can only use it for a school that has been certified by the Department of Public Instruction to allow that school to participate in the choice program. And we've seen some schools removed from the program when they're frankly, they're bad schools. So the accountability is there in school choice, but it is applied at the level of people receiving and spending the money, not at the institutions that are receiving it.
And Peg Lautenschlager, last word to you.
Yeah, well, to pretend that the accountability is not attached to the service providers is just plain wrong. While there may not be much accountability with providers, say grocers or people giving out the food stamps, there is certainly accountability with both of them if they indeed violate the law. If a grocer were to afford somebody the opportunity to buy things which are not within the food stamp program or swap them in or take them and give them money instead, that grocer would be held accountable. If somebody in social services were to give food stamps to somebody who does not meet the criteria, that person is held accountable. We look in the area of in medical care, and we look at something programs like Medicaid and Medicare. My goodness, I mean, as a federal and state prosecutor, we prosecuted hundreds of service providers who were playing the system and gaming the system and committing fraud. Likewise, if you have people who are providing education who are committing fraud, who are not living up to expectations, there should be an accountability. And there is. And there ought to be, though, more, because the accountability that's placed on public schools, particularly in terms of performance, is far greater and far more rigid and far more manipulated than it is for the schools that don't have these requirements on them, the voucher schools. One example quickly is that we had the board that was going to review public schools. One of the things the vast majority of the board of the commission members determined was that schools should not get report card grades, but instead there should be measures where you could adequately look at various categories of issues so as to make a balanced and thoughtful determination as to how public schools were faring. And yet, despite the fact that they refused to release information about specific schools when it comes to vouchers because we need to look at the full picture, we've done just the opposite in terms of our accountability of public schools, where the commission, despite its recommendations not to use letter grades to rate schools, the Walker administration turned that on its head and issued letter grades anyway. So we're seeing a double standard here. We're seeing things operate one way for public entities, we're seeing another way operated for private entities, and that's just plain wrong.
Let's move on from vouchers. One of the items that did not make it into the budget was a proposal, well, never actually made it there, was a proposal that involved restricting public access to the proposed iron mine site in northern Wisconsin. There was some thought Republicans were thinking about giving the DNR the power to set up some rules to keep protesters there at bay as Göbek Taconite is doing some preliminary testing at the site. But they walked back on that proposal, so it didn't wind up in the budget. Owen, let's start with you. Was this something Republicans should have included in the budget, or were they right to keep it out?
No, they should not have included it in the budget. It's not a budgetary item, and of course, there's a list of things that aren't that are in there. That why I hear Peg chuckling there. But no, it shouldn't have been included. I think it's a reactionary thing, fear of eco-terrorism in that area, which we've already seen a little bit of vandalism and whatnot. But I don't think there's any need to or any requirement to set up different rules around there than other citizens in other part of the state must adhere to.
And Peg Lautenschlager.
I'm not quite sure how, you know, painting a sign that says, you know, out-of-state mining corporations, go home and quit raping our land, rises to the level of eco-terrorism. You know, I mean, we've had various cases in the state of Wisconsin. I recall in the 1990s there was a a group, that kind of an anarchist group that was releasing minks from mink farms. I got involved in the prosecution of that. Minks are not necessarily lovely little animals you want in the wilderness, and secondly, they really aren't. Those that are being bred aren't equipped to survive there. But so we've had different things like this throughout our state's history. I think the real tragedy here is simply that we have loosened rules in a way that almost most states have not when it comes to mining, and yet we are not affording the public who will pay the long-term consequences of the rule changes to have any access whatsoever. It seems as though the ability to utilize one's First Amendment rights, frankly, for people of both political philosophies, tends to be situational. And in the end, it comes down not to whether or not those First Amendment rights exist, but whether or not you're for or against what the people purporting to, or the people wanting to use them, purport to support.
Amy joins us now from Waupun. Hi, Amy.
Hello, Jamie. I'm sorry.
Oh, I'm sorry, Jamie. I misread your name.
No problem. Yesterday, I sat in front of my computer from 10 o'clock until 12:15, not essentially, but and I watched as amendment after amendment was tabled. My senator, Senator Goodix, told me personally last week that he had no problem voting for Amendment Number 28, which was the removal of language of the MRF. He didn't stand up and say anything in favor of it, and he didn't. Then he voted to table it. Glenn Grothman did stand up, and he talked about compassion and smirked about it because he was using the Democratic language against them, like laughing at them. And then he smirked while he was talking about, you know, let's table this. My question is, with leadership keeping everyone in line other than Dale Schultz, what else could the Democrats have done to actually have had any of their amendments actually heard and actually voted on and actually passed?
Peg Lautenschlager, let's start with you.
Well, first, Jamie, I didn't catch what amendment you were talking about. It was Amendment 28, but what did it do? It removed language.
Yeah, it removed the language of the MRF, the mandatory refundable fee, which pretty much, like, with the language in the bill, it kind of decimates United Council. And Glenn Grothman stood up and said that 18 times he put it to the floor in the last 18 years.
Okay. Yeah, so this is involving United Council for the Colleges?
Yeah, that's correct. It was in. It turned up in Joint Finance and got turned down there.
Right, yeah. You know, frankly, this game has been played by people of both parties. I think what we've seen, though, is over the last probably two decades, in previous budgets, say 20, 30 years ago, there were always a good handful, if not more, amendments where bipartisan coalitions would say this is something we don't want from the governor's budget, or this is, we're doing the budget differently in terms of our house of the legislature. But we always had different provisions which either made it in or were taken out based on these coalitions and common sense. What you started to get, and frankly, I think it was probably in the early 90s, was about the time I left the legislature, was this notion that caucuses needed to vote lockstep with the other members of the caucus. And you saw it, frankly, from Democrats and Republicans alike. You see it right now with House Republicans in national government. But this notion that you cannot jump ship. And if you can jump ship on some of these amendments, it's only with a carefully calculated jump where they're sure they have enough votes and they're letting you go because they think that that might enhance your election prospects, re-election prospects. So, you know, I think that's wrong. I think we're going in the wrong direction on that kind of philosophy where everybody is essentially goes in there as a non-thinking human being and votes as they're told to vote. You know, that doesn't seem to me to be reflective of democracy. It doesn't seem as though that means that legislators are kind of reflecting the wishes of their districts in some ways. And then they always fall behind this. Well, it was in the budget. There wasn't anything I could do, or I tried to do something, but I couldn't, or there were enough votes, blah, blah, blah. It's excuse making, and it's wrong. And I think this budget was worse than the last, and last budget was worse than the one before that. So that's my opinion.
Owen Robinson, let's get a response from you before we break.
Sure. And Jamie, to answer your question, what could they have done to get more amendments passed is really not much. They're in the minority. If they don't have the votes there, they don't have the votes. The reason to put up these amendments is specifically to put everybody on record either voting for or against it so that then it can be used later for campaigns, frankly. In your case, your senator, if he told you that he was willing to support that and then voted to table that, contradicting what he told you, I suggest that you make effort to hold him accountable at the next election.
Okay, we're going to take a break. When we return, we will follow up with more stories from the Week in Review. A reminder that coming up tonight on Here and Now on Wisconsin Public Television, we'll hear more about the state budget. Assembly Speaker Robin Voss and Senate Minority Leader Chris Larson will be on Here and Now tonight, and they'll be talking about the state budget, which is now in the hands of Governor Walker. That's Here and Now, coming up tonight at 7:30 on Wisconsin Public Television. I'm Gene Purcell, and for Joy Cardine, this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Fifteen minutes before 9 o'clock, this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Gene Purcell, in for Joy Cardine. It's the Week in Review, and more specifically, it's time for the Week in Review quiz. Now, listeners, if you want to take a stab at the quiz, give us a call at 800-642-1234 or email talk@wpr.org. We'll be picking a random winner from all the correct answers. That person will win a copy of one of the books we recently featured on the program this week. So here you go. Here's the question. A story came out this week about a 2005 encounter that happened in Russia involving New England's Patriots owner, Bob Kraft, and Russian President Vladimir Putin. Kraft reportedly told a recent crowd in New York that Putin took a certain valuable item from him during that visit. What was that item? So here's the question again. A 2005 encounter happened in Russia. There was a story this week about it. New York, New England Patriots owner Bob Kraft and Russian President Vladimir Putin were meeting. Kraft reportedly told a recent crowd in New York that Putin took a certain valuable item from him during that visit. What was that item? We'll have the answer for you towards the end of the show. Again, give us a call at 800-642-1234 if you know the answer, or you can email the answer at talk@wpr.org. Let's get back to the Week in Review here, and one more state story before we move on to some other stories from around the world. Let's start with Peg Lautenschlager on this one. Democratic State Representative Brett Halsey of Madison is considering switching his party affiliation to become an independent. Is this news? Is this important, or is this just interesting?
I think it's good for the Democrats is what I think, but I'm not, I really, you know, I mean, he is a single legislator. Clearly he has had a contentious relationship in terms of his personal relationship, in terms of dealing with his caucus, and, you know, is in one of those seats where when you come out of the primary, it's difficult to defeat you. If he does become an independent, like I say, I don't think that it's going to have any dire consequences on the Democrats. Clearly, his rationale for it, regardless of what he articulates publicly, is simply that he has been frustrated in his own demands that he has placed on his colleagues, and I think they too are disappointed with parts of his performance, and as a result of it, if he declares himself an independent, I don't think that it really in any way changes Wisconsin politics.
Owen Robinson?
I tend to agree. I think the Democrats are probably glad to be rid of him. It's not like he's a very liberal man. It's not like he's going to turn around and start voting with the Republicans or caucusing with them. So it doesn't change any power structure at all. And you know, I think Halsey has shown some rather strange behavior of late, and I think the Democrats would rather not be tied to it.
800-642-1234. Yeah, that's the number to call if you'd like to call in with a comment or question for our guests. On the national scene, one of the stories that just happened last night, I think, or yesterday sometime, in the House of Representatives, the Farm Bill, which has been talked about, we haven't had a Farm Bill, I don't think, in 4 or 5 years. And it looked as though we were heading towards one, and then all of a sudden, yesterday, It just didn't happen. And now there are all sorts of questions about Republicans' ability to lead in the House, where they hold a pretty substantial majority there. Owen Robinson, let's start with you on this. First of all, to the bill in general, disappointed to see it disappear? And what does this say, if anything, about Republican power in the House of Representatives?
Well, I think, and like you, I'm reading the news this morning, trying to figure out what happened. And I think as we see it from the bill itself, I'm not too disappointed to see it go down. I think that there's the farm bill tends to get loaded up with a lot of junk, frankly, that needs to be stripped out, needs to be cleaned up before it goes through. So I'm happy to see they'll put some more work into it, hopefully make it better, hopefully not make it worse. But I think the most significant thing about that is you see that Speaker John Boehner clearly has lost control of the caucus. And I think that there's a significant Republican bloc within the House that isn't following his lead anymore. So I think that while he easily won the speakership again in the last run, even though there was talk then even that he may be challenged, nobody challenged him. But I think Republicans need to understand where their leadership is coming from, because they clearly have lost confidence in the Speaker of the House.
Peg Lautenschlager.
Well, I agree with Owen wholeheartedly on the Boehner issue. I mean, this isn't your parents' Republican Party anymore, and it's clear that those groups that I view as being more out there, more representative of the political fringe, have really done a masterful job in terms of controlling that house of the legislature, not only over the minority Democrats, but also over what used to be the old school Republicans. I think the real tragedy for this comes in not just in terms of this loss of leadership and inability to govern as a result of it. When it comes to Boehner, I think the other tragedy is that while the farm bill always has been a Christmas tree of benefits, whether it be tobacco growers or dairy producers who don't live in Wisconsin but live far away from Eau Claire and the crazy formula and all of these other things, the farm bill does a number of very important things in terms of giving predictability to farmers who produce our food and to those who consume their food, and it also provides food for poor children. And for the political rancoring among Republicans, I mean, Democrats weren't even involved in any of this, for the political rancoring among Republicans not getting their act together in a singular way, for all of these other people, from people who are farmers to people who are consumers to people who rely on a little extra help from the government just to get through school each day without hunger pains, I think that it's wrong. You know, if you don't want to govern, then it seems difficult for me to understand why somebody who doesn't want to govern wants to be in government, other than if they want to collect a salary or get a kick out of the fact that they have some political power. But, you know, this is a nation that's a democracy, and governing is about governing, and being elected to public office is about governing. And I think the Republicans made a big mistake yesterday when it came to dealing with that farm bill.
Immigration reform has been a big topic, too, and that Gang of Eight proposal looks like it could be getting closer to having something actually happen here. Lawmakers, there one of the issues in this whole immigration reform bill is that there would be a lot of money spent, billions of dollars reportedly, to stiffen up border security requirements without delaying legalization for millions of people who already live in the country illegally. Owen Robinson, let's start with you. In the scheme of things, how important should border security be in this discussion?
I think border security is paramount. Frankly, the reason that we're even having the big immigration debate is because we have the 11 or 14 million, whoever's counting it today, illegal immigrants that are quote unquote in the shadows in America, that they're here, but they're not participating in society, as you know, paying their taxes and all those kinds of things, that we want to bring them out and have them be, you know, have a path to citizenship, as it's termed. But if you don't seal the border first, all you're doing is moving that group of people into mainstream American society while allowing the next batch to come along. And we're just going to have this same debate in 15 years when the next generation's up, just like we're having the same debate now that we had back in the 80s over this exact same issue. So sealing that border first is absolutely critical, which is why many Republicans are opposing this immigration reform without it. I will say that the amendment that came up just in the past few days, which purports to seal the border prior to providing green cards to all the illegal immigrants that are already here, is a bit of a farce. It doesn't require those measures to be in place. It has no hard measures of what success is in sealing the border. All it does is say we're going to spend a bunch of money on border security. We're going to kind of get started on it. And once we say we have a good start, we're going to go ahead with amnesty for all the illegal aliens that are here. So I think that all that amendment is designed to do is give cover for Republicans who want to vote for this, but can't do so without at least pretending that they've secured the border.
Peg Lautenschlager.
Well, I think sealing the border is a red herring that's being used now by people of a certain political philosophy who essentially want to make immigration reform impossible. You know, does sealing the border mean that not one undocumented person ever comes in through the border? Does it mean not 10? Does it mean not 100? Does it mean that we build higher walls? Does it mean that we put in an electric fence? Does it mean that we have people every, 100 yards with machine guns shooting folks who try to come in without documents? I mean, it's starting to sound like East Berlin. I went to East Germany and East Berlin as a student in 1972, and I remember what going through that border was like, and thinking about the horror of it and how, this isn't like America, and yet we keep nudging closer to that sort of a scene, particularly on our south border. We don't seem to be as worried about our north border. But that being said, I think immigration reform is of paramount importance. I'm part of a very active group supporting immigration reform. That group is bipartisan. That group includes law enforcement officers, some current and many former state's attorneys general of both parties. And what we recognize from people who've been involved in law enforcement is that sealing the border isn't the primary law enforcement need. The primary law enforcement need is getting folks to come out of the shadows, because as we deal with law enforcement issues within this country right now, the fact that we have this broken immigration system makes us less safe. We spend a lot of time worrying about people who are coming over the border without papers, but who aren't posing a threat to American society. They're taking minimum wage or below minimum wage jobs. There are issues there, but they are not criminals. They are not rapists. They are not drug dealers. They are not anybody who's posing a threat in that way. And we have law enforcement people who are spending their time having to worry about those folks who are there other than worrying about the criminals, both within this country and those coming over the border illegally. We also have issues in terms of the communities where immigrants may live. And even those immigrants with appropriate documentation are afraid to speak with or cooperate with the police. We can't effectively do community policing because everybody's worried that perhaps a relative of theirs or someone they know who doesn't have the appropriate documentation may be deported if they come to the fore or if they in any way have contact with law enforcement. The reasons are many, but there are good, solid reasons that immigration reform leads to a safer United States, and it's that focus which we ought to maintain. Of this group of folks, both current attorneys general and a group of former attorneys general have sent letters to Congress emphasizing these concerns and emphasizing the need to come up with a program that affords us logical enforcement options, both in terms of immigration and in terms of those issues which have some perhaps tangential relationship to it.
All right, it's actually time to reveal the answer now, and the winner, as soon as I get that information, I will be happy to pass it along to you. It's time to reveal the answer of our Week in Review quiz, and the question was, which item did Russian President Vladimir Putin reportedly take from New England Patriots owner Bob Kraft in 2005? And I'll ask our guest, do either one of you know?
Yes.
Yep.
Super Bowl ring.
Oh, you got it. Both of you. Wow. Wow. We would have given you a prize, but we don't allow you to answer, of course. Yeah, that's exactly right. A Super Bowl ring. Kraft says he showed the ring to Putin. And here's the story. Putin apparently took the ring, put it on his finger. After Putin looked at it for a while, Kraft says he stuck his hand out to take it back, but Putin put it in his pocket and was then escorted out by three guys from the KGB. The ring is apparently at a library in the Kremlin where all official state gifts are kept. So there you go. And our winner is Lynn in Milton. So thanks so much, Lynn. And Peg Lautenschlager, Owen Robinson, thanks both of you for joining us as well.
Always a pleasure.
Thank you.
All right. Owen Robinson and Peg Lautenschlager joining us on the Week in Review. And we take a look at all the stories, well, not all of them, but a good chunk of them, that make a difference here in Wisconsin and the world. I'm Gene Purcell. I've been filling in this week for Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.